Here's one of the most urgent questions facing every technology services leader today. Is my organization evolving fast enough? I'm Thomas Law, the executive director of TSIA, and welcome to Tectonic, the podcast where we explore what makes technology business models successful in today's world. And my guest today has a front row seat to service transformation. His name is Rajat Shah. He's the Vice President of Services at Tetra Pak. Rajat leads global service operations for one of the world's most sophisticated industrial technology companies on the planet. From food safety to automation to digitization, Tetra Pak has long been at the forefront of operational excellence. And in this episode, we'll explore how new capabilities are evolving the Tetra Pak services organization and reshaping roles and skill sets across their workforce. So let's get the insight engine humming. Rajat, welcome to Tectonic. It's very nice to meet you. And, you know, for the folks in the audience who don't know who Tetra Pak is, why don't you just sort of explain what the company is all about?
Thank you, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be here. Tetra Pak is a global leader in food packaging and processing solutions. We operate in about 200 countries around the world. There are not more than 200 countries in the world. And we have a workforce of 26,000 people. In terms of service, because you talked about service and this show is all about service. So we deliver about 5 million hours of service every year to our customers, which is a big number. Our brand promise is simple, that it is to make food safe and available everywhere. And I would say to your audience as well that if you have ever had milk, juice, or water in your life, you have probably interacted with Tetra Pak.
Yeah. So I was excited to get you on because you do have such a massive field service organization. You have so much equipment that is out there that people are relying on, right? To be up and running, to be safe, and all those things. And so I'm really curious about how the technology is changing in terms of how you service that equipment, right? Because there's things like, you know, augmented reality tools, there's live video collaboration platforms. And so where are you seeing sort of the biggest ROI or the biggest benefits in new technology for field services?
It's a great question. And when I talk about the installed base, for example, and the number of service hours that we deliver, more than 100,000 equipment all over the world, 5 million service hours, I would say the biggest ROI is coming from remote support in terms of our providing remote support to our customers. And I would say the journey started almost 10 years ago, and we started in a very, maybe an opportunistic way. We were using phone calls or some kind of a video call tools. And then we started going more into augmented reality wearables as well, something like HoloLens, for example. But then we had certain benefits, but it was not practically possible for our service engineers to have a big device on their heads while they're working on a very critical equipment. Then I would say after that, there was a few years of remote support winter because the technology was fragmented all over the place. And then pandemic hit the world. And that's when remote support became extremely important again.
Yeah. Necessity, you know, right, is the mother of invention.
Absolutely. And then that's when we went at a very, very fast pace. And we built holistically all required capabilities, a CRM, WhatsApp integration, many more technologies with new kind of variables, which are less unwieldy, and language support, language translation. And now we have even AI integration to our remote support and our background knowledge of our equipment. So now today, for example, if you go back 10 years ago, an engineer in Brazil would call somebody in Sweden on a shaky phone line. Today, we have a virtual AI engine available for our new college graduate who goes to a customer site and has all sorts of support available for them. So I would say that's where the highest ROI is coming from.
Yeah. So a lot of our members are B2B enterprise tech providers. And so, you know, they might have servers or routers or things like that, you know, deployed on a customer site. And that equipment typically is very connected, right? I mean, you can dial into it, you can service it. Give me a sense of, you know, because again, you're out in all these different kind of manufacturing environments, you have a wide array of different kind of products. How connected are those products? In other words, when they're having problems, they're contacting you proactively and saying, hey, you know, we're going to have a failure or whatever. Is that common yet for your equipment?
I would say across all the industries, food and beverage is probably one of the ones that is more conservative in their approach towards connected equipment.
Interesting.
And if you look within food and beverage industry, probably we are at a pretty good stage. We started our connected equipment in a way of performance measurement many years ago. That was about performance measurement in terms of line MME, PTU, etc., those kind of things. But then if you talk about IIoT-based connected equipment and predicting failures from happening, that also is a journey that we have gone through. And now we are at a certain percentage, maybe in the beginning of double digit, probably percentage of our installed equipment, which is connected from a predictive maintenance standpoint. But there is still a lot of journey to cover here.
Yeah. That's interesting. And so you made the statement that in the food and beverage, that those customers are a little bit more conservative in terms of getting equipment connected. Is it just because they're sort of old school and they don't see the benefit, or do they have other concerns? Why are they conservative in terms of taking advantage of, you know, IoT type of capabilities?
I think if we compare it with a process industry, for example, an oil and gas industry, it is definitely much, much more important that there should be a focus on predictive maintenance from a standpoint of overall operations. When it comes to food and beverage industry, and I would say for all the right reasons, the big focus is on the quality and on the safety of the product itself. And that's where most of the investment from food and beverage industry players, as well as from suppliers like us, for example, has gone into. And now we are getting into that area where we really focus on maintenance and going into predictive maintenance and those kind of areas as well.
Because that's about efficiency. It's really about keeping the lines up and running, and there's a lot of money that could be saved there. Obviously, you know, the more connected that equipment is. So that's super interesting.
And that's realizing that, definitely.
So, I mean, you know, it's funny, this the promise of IoT, which has been on the table for many, many, many years now, it is really interesting to watch those capabilities are unfolding at very different paces in different industries. Some industries very connected, and other industries are like, well, like you said, 10-15% of the customers may be there. So it really is fascinating to watch, you know, how that's different across vertical industries. I want to go back to, you made the comment about for your field engineers now, they can leverage an AI virtual assistant, you know, when they're working with a customer. Talk a little bit about how, with technology changing, how is that changing the profile of these field service engineers for you and their skills and kind of what you look for? What are you seeing there?
Yeah, I would say the profile of the engineers when it comes to a kind of engineer that Tetra Pak or one of our food and beverage customers would look for probably has not changed that much from a technical skills, from a mechanical and from an electrical skills. I would say one skill that has really started to see a lot of focus on is ability to get into automation and digital areas. That is definitely one area that is quite important. When it comes to the overall capability of our engineers, I would say that ability to transform themselves from an old way of working to a new way of working when it comes to things like digital journeys or digital trainings, for example, or things like ability to use artificial intelligence, automation, etc. That is one area we have focused quite a lot on. In general, I would say the big focus has still been that we provide the best technical expertise to our customers when it comes to their equipment.
It's interesting. We had a guest on a little while ago from an AI startup, Bruvati, I think it was, and their CEO was on, and they are making new AI capabilities to help field service engineers, right, when they're on site, diagnose problems and you know, a couple other different capabilities. And he had an interesting premise about how the world of field service technicians was going to change. And he was saying that historically, that has been a job that has been very mechanical, right? You're going to go in, you got to take panels off, you got to move wires, you got to. And so it's really thinking about somebody who likes that, right? They're very mechanical. And it's a profession that I know a lot of our members, they struggle sort of recruiting people into that, keeping people in that area. And so his premise is that AI is making these field service technicians like software engineers, very digital, right? They're interacting, like you said, with AI, with different software diagnostic tools, and it is much more of a software engineering type of job. And he said that he was excited that he thought that would make it a little bit easier to recruit people that get excited about using those new technologies. And it is going to be a different profile of person. And like you're saying, the technical know-how does not go away. You need people that are comfortable with technology, but it's almost like less mechanical, you know, more digital in terms of the profile. Is that something that you're seeing within your workforce?
Yeah, from a knowledge of tools and from a ability to use the tools, absolutely, I agree. That is definitely a thing that we are seeing. And then the other thing definitely that we are seeing is that with the workforce aging, especially our engineers and the engineers who have a lot of knowledge in a certain area, we need to also focus on how do we bring that knowledge back into the organization before, for example, they retire, and then we manage that knowledge. Because if we don't manage that knowledge, then building an AI on it and then bringing a new recruit from college to use that knowledge is going to be impossible. So that is one area that definitely has to be focused upon as well. But truly, like you said, there is going to be a change. I don't see necessarily the engineers of our equipment becoming software engineers totally. But there would be definitely some kind of transition. Yes.
Well, I think they're just going to have to be very comfortable interacting with software at a level that they, you know, again, whether it's an AI agent, whether it's a different software tool that is leveraging AI that's guiding them through diagnosis, it's going to be a different profile. I also think, you know, like you said, capturing expertise as people are retiring. And I mean, that's another common theme we hear from our members. Again, they have an aging workforce, people that have been, you know, field service technician for years, they know a lot, and they're getting ready to retire. To me, it feels like AI is a saving grace here as a way to capture a lot of that knowledge and preserve it and make it easy to be accessible to the workforce that's coming from behind. Do you see that opportunity as well?
Indeed. Absolutely. Good. What we have tried to do is we have created these applications for our engineers that they can use on their mobile phone. And then whenever they hit some kind of area at a customer site where a certain knowledge is needed, then they use those apps to upload information about the equipment or the root cause analysis that they did. And all of that gets converted into some kind of a relatable database that we are trying to use now for our knowledge management. So absolutely, the profile of engineers and ability to use these kind of apps, these kind of tools, plus bringing that knowledge in, all needs to work in a very seamless fashion in order to really get there.
The economics of enterprise tech are breaking. AI startups are threatening the domain of long-established enterprise technology providers. Yet, it is unclear exactly how technology providers will drive profitable revenue in the AI era. TSIA has always been focused on what it takes to have a profitable business model in enterprise tech. AI Economics is a body of actionable TSIA research that is digging into the future of tech business models. How will AI solutions be priced? What does the next generation tech services portfolio look like? And why does TSI believe that it is not the end of tech services, but the era of services? Go to tsia.com/AI economics to learn the answers. Let's talk about the value proposition for your customers. You know, within a field service organization, obviously, primary value proposition has always been the fact that I can keep stuff up and running for you. And if we move from reactive maintenance to predictive maintenance, that's a beautiful thing. But moving beyond that, helping customers with value propositions like, hey, I can optimize your production schedule. I can help you literally reduce waste and quantify that. How does your company approaching those types of conversations with customers?
I would say this is a very, very important area of focus for us. If we move forward in terms of gaining more trust and more connect with our customers, the only way to do that is bringing our customers to next level of service solutions. So we have a pretty good focus on having service solutions with our customers, long-term service agreements. But then our big strategy, I would say, is to really go with advanced agreements where we can take some kind of a commitment about a certain performance that we can deliver to the customer, some kind of operational saving and those kind of things. Yeah. So this is definitely an area that is evolving super fast in this industry.
So TSI, we believe a lot in anchoring on value realization or outcomes. And we believe that most technology providers, right, whether we're buying hardware or software, that's where customers are going to want to go. And that's what's going to allow you to maintain premium pricing, et cetera. And so it's interesting, you know, a lot of companies struggle connecting the dots between their technology and a very specific outcome, right? It's just like, so they're like, they kind of can connect the dots, but they can't. But in your case, it sounds like there are some very real performance metrics like reducing waste that you feel you can ultimately connect the dots to, that you can show your customers, hey, by leveraging our technology, this particular hardware or software, whatever, we can reduce waste by whatever percentage. Is that the conversations that you're in?
Exactly. Yeah. Not just waste. There are things like line efficiency, for example, or operational cost of the equipment, for example. Now there are even areas, for example, when we connect our IIoT connected equipment together with a performance-based contract, we can even help the customers reduce the total cost of ownership from a maintenance standpoint as well. So all of those things combined now, I think this is the right time when all these different technologies can combine together, because in the end, the customer wants reliable operation. They want lowest TCO when they run an equipment, and then they basically need a good night's sleep. So I think all of that can be provided together in a solution.
Talk a little bit about performance-based contracts, because you know that's an area where, again, forever we've been talking about delivering outcomes, you know, for our customers. But then when it comes down to actually contracting that way, right? Like actually writing a contract that says, these are the, you know, specific efficiencies or whatever that we're going to deliver for you. That's when it can get dicey. Either you as the provider says, I don't know if I want to write on the bottom line there. Or even we hear a lot from our members, the customers go, I've never contracted that way before. So what are you seeing when you're working with customers and you want to put that type of contract in place that is, you know, related to some kind of outcomes? What's your experience there?
I think it comes down to what level of trust the customer has in us. And I think the thing that has really worked well in terms of our organizational structure, in the way we work with our customers, we have a pretty good focus on having a account management team with our customers who work in a long-term fashion with the customer. So we review a customer's performance data together with them maybe every week or every month. That level of connect always happens. So the customer knows that we know the data, we know what is happening at their equipment. We have these customer performance dashboards and we review with them on a regular basis. And the dashboards are what the customer really wants to see, not what we want to see. So I think this level of connect probably helps us in having at least same set of data. And when we have the same set of data, it is much easier to talk the same language. And then the second thing I would say is delivering performance, right? If the customer sees that we can provide them reliable operations, even without a contract, then they are much more ready to sign a contract, a higher level contract. So I would say our big focus is to ensure that we provide still the best technical expertise to our customers, even without the contract and, of course, with the contract.
So I'm going to play that back because I think that there's some fundamental precursors there to being able to do, you know, outcome-based types of contracts. So the one thing I heard is that trust is super important. They're not going to do that type of contract unless they already really feel you know them and you have a really super solid relationship. So it's not something you just come out of the gate with typically. Okay, so that's number one. Number two, what you said is the fact that there needs to be transparency on the data, that everybody's looking at the same data and there's no like, oh, this is in your system and this is in my system and we're kind of trying to compare, what did you really do? It's got to be very transparent, the same set of metrics that everybody is looking at. And then the third thing you said is you have to deliver on the basics first. You have to basically say, look, we are delivering you reliability. Look at this. You know, we've been a partner of yours for X amount of years doing this. That gives you the right to climb up the value ladder, if you will, and have, you know, a more sophisticated conversation. But without those three things in place, you don't have the trust, you don't have transparency data, you haven't delivered, you know, on the basics yet, then it's going to be super hard to try to convince them to go into some kind of outcome-based relationship with you. Is that fair?
I think you have said it absolutely the right way. I mean, I wouldn't have said it in a better way, I would say. Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. That's also good. It's a really a great thread, because again, a lot of our members want to go there. They want to be in those kind of relationships, but they really struggle to get there. And I think the more and more we understand, again, what are the variables required to get there, is it's just good for the industry to understand that. So let's talk about, again, kind of back to employees utilizing things like digital learning platforms and to rapidly upskill your field engineers. How is that game changing? What are you doing there?
Another great area of focus for us, digital learning, especially when you look at our total number of service engineers around the world, around 3,000 engineers, right? And we spend a lot of money on training them on a regular basis. So what we have identified is that, and that too also working with our customers as well, is that many of our trainings were probably focusing on areas which were not necessarily what the engineer wanted to do or needed to learn, for example. So we had some very, very structured training programs, and the engineer goes into that training program already knowing 50% of the thing that the training would tell them. So they only gain benefit of the remaining 50%. What we try to do is to develop a skill matrix for every single engineer in terms of the real work that they really need to do. And that skill matrix is worked together by them and their team leader. And based on that, what we identified is what is the right content or customized kind of training that we can deliver to that engineer so that they gain the maximum benefit out of it. That's probably one of the big ones. And then we started focusing on developing digital trainings according to that. Yeah. And then the second area that we focused on was really deploying the 70-20-10 approach. You've probably heard about it quite a lot. But so basically 10% is a classroom or a digital training. 20% is with a coach, where you just go with a coach engineer.
Okay.
See how the coach does. And 70% is actually doing the things yourself. So we started going for this learning journey, which is totally based on this 70-20-10 approach. And what we have seen is that now 44% of our trainings are through this learning journey approach. By doing this, we are able to shrink down our time of engineer readiness from joining the company to really doing something and delivering some kind of a service event to our customer.
So I'm not familiar with the 70-20-10 model. And how long ago did you deploy that? How recently did you move into that model?
It's maybe fourth year of really structured approach of deploying it. Yeah, we already always knew about it. We had not really done it. And now over the last 4 years, we have really deployed it in a very structured manner.
So that is a best practice in the industry with field service engineers to structure the learning that way to go with that 70-20-10 model. Is that where you got it from?
I would say that's probably a general learning approach. And not just for a field service engineer, but even for anything else as well. If you do an industry research, for example, on just capability development, you would probably see this or some kind of it in a way. Because what the industry has finally realized, and probably rightly so, is that most of the learning comes by doing your work yourself.
I think to me, what's fascinating about learning skills right now in the AI age is, and I see it with our own employees, I see it with myself, I hear it when I, talking to other members, you have these super powerful AI engines that can be just optimized and tuned to your content, right? To the things that you need to learn. And so in the old days, you could be a field service technician, you could be a software engineer, you could be whatever, CS person. You're doing your job and you get stuck. And then you're like, okay, let me go look for this documentation. And you're hoping the documentation is exactly perfectly right. And if that doesn't make sense or is outdated, then you got to go find somebody, right? And so there's a lot of friction there. And now when you get stuck, you're like, oh, wait a minute. You just asked the engine and the engine is always up to date. It's always learning. It's like talking to the smartest peer you could possibly find. And it's there real time. To me, a massive game changer.
Indeed. I mean, it's a great benefit for the whole industry for sure. Yeah. And we see the benefits of it trickling down every single day. For sure.
Every Tectonic listener is well aware. I am a big believer that AI is a game changer for how professionals in the technology industry will do their jobs. TSI Research is not immune to that reality. I am proud to say that we have been aggressively experimenting on how AI can change the way we create research and deliver those research insights to our members. And now we are ready to release TSIA Intelligence, the first Gen AI model designed exclusively for technology services. Unlike generic Gen AI tools, TSIA Intelligence taps into our real-world, industry-validated data that is not in the public domain. We have designed this model to give you clear, actionable, and board-ready insights. Right now, in technology services, the stakes are really high. Every decision counts. Good decisions can build your career. Bad ones can end it. General LLMs are incredibly powerful, but you need specialized insights built on industry data that you can trust. That is TSI Intelligence. To check it out, visit tsi.com/intelligence. And now I'm curious, do you notice, because what I'm also seeing, there are some professionals that light bulb's gone off and they are leveraging the heck out of AI in ways that they're learning on their own, plus ways that the company's presenting. And there are other professionals that are still like, they're just like the light bulb hasn't gone off yet. Do you see that same kind of curve still evolving?
For us, I think we have just recently crossed that threshold of should we do it, should we not do it?
Yeah,
really, let's just get it done.
Good.
I think the big reason that we made this shift was that we, of course, first of all, we started seeing a lot of examples, not just in our industry, but all over the world coming out from the benefits of AI. But then we did something pretty interesting was that we put together a team across the services function. So from, for example, from part supply chain, one person, from customer service operation, from issue resolution, from product management. And then we started looking at, okay, let's figure out what are the business use cases where we can apply AI. And in the last 1 month, we got 30 use cases. And out of those 30 use cases, we are already now deploying three of them. And that all just happened in the last 1 month. So I would say, exactly. Connecting the technology team and the business team. And then finding out use cases is one of the biggest game changer for us in this area.
Well, I mean, the story that you're telling is, again, one that I hear again and again and again. And every time I read an article and they're like, AI, we don't know if there's really benefits there. Maybe it's just a bubble. Maybe there's a lot of hype. The reality is when you really start to lean into it, like you're describing, you quickly identify a lot of compelling use cases, a lot. Like you said, you identified 30. I'm sure they're all awesome. And then you prioritize and you pick, okay, let's pick these three first. And then you're going to go to the next three. And the next three, and you're going to be working on chipping on that for the next, you know, X amount of years. But every time you deploy one of those cases, your productivity is just going higher and higher and higher. It's amazing.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. If you think about it, I mean, one very interesting use case, I mean, the way people are even developing their own capabilities. So for example, we were deploying this field service management solution just recently. And internally, we also put together an entire process document for it because it's a big solution. So the process document itself is like 100 pages to go through. And then the person working on the project has no AI capability himself. I mean, he didn't learn it himself, but then he started learning on Copilot Studio and he created a chatbot for that process document by himself.
Yeah.
And he just developed that capability in the organization itself. So I'm super
happy. And again, that resulting capability, a chatbot against that document is so much easier as an employee to work with than trying to go through the 100-page process document.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
nobody
it's a different,
wants to go through a process document, but everyone wants to talk to an AI chatbot.
They want the answer. They want the answer. It's like, here's my question. Don't make me go to page number 45 and try to figure out that that's what the answer is, because I'm asleep by the time I get there anyway. But you know, it's just like, I just want to ask the question and have that chatbot say, oh yeah, here's that specific answer. So it's very different. Yeah, I want to shift gears a little bit. I want to talk about how your service processes are changing, because there's new technology there as well. There's things like, you know, robotic process automation and other automation tools. Where are you seeing the biggest, you know, gains or changes there in just, you know, your service processes?
Yeah, robotic process automation. This is one area where we also started working almost 4 or 5 years ago, I would say. Uh-huh. And I think the area that has benefited the most is our part supply chain, or what we call a service supply network nowadays. And why that happened was because there were a lot of non-integrated digital tools that we were using earlier. And for example, when you go from an entire value chain, a customer needs a quotation. From quotation, you give the quotation back. The quotation converts into purchase order. The purchase order comes back. Then we do order processing in our ERP system. Then the part goes back and delivered to the customer along with some kind of a tracking mechanism. All of that was non-integrated, done by people. And when you have a standard process, which is repetitive, it has some kind of a digital tool, and it is enterprise knowledge is there associated with it, it's a prime candidate for RPA.
Automation.
We have saved like hours, like thousands of hours by just doing RPA around it.
So to give people a sense of, you know, how long that journey is. So you started that about 4 years ago. How long did it take before you started to see real benefits from that initiative?
Yeah, we started small, and that was probably the right strategy. So we started chipping away at the issue one at a time. And I would say from an ROI perspective, RPAs probably deliver an ROI of or a payback period of maybe less than a month. Month to month, probably. That's how that's level of results you get from RPAs. Yeah.
So,
I would say that's how we started getting our results so quickly from RPAs.
Yeah, that's it. Well, that's good. I haven't clicked with any of our guests into that particular
type of initiative. And so, I mean, that is a fast ROI. That's fantastic if you could start to, yes. But it makes sense. Because like you said, you're taking a lot of labor that's in there, you know, and you're saying, hey, boom, we can just,
exactly.
We can make, now that's huge.
But I think the key is to find small areas, not like huge, big area where the robot also gets totally confused. That's, you're not there yet. Yeah. So I think that's what we have to focus on.
I mean, I believe in this current wave of technology between automation, between AI, et cetera. I think a lot of our processes, there's going to be this great rationalization. We have a lot of complexity in our business processes that have built up over the years, especially a company like yourself. You're in all these countries. You've got all this, you know, different technology in play. Over the years, you just end up with just tons of processes and often managed by pieces, parts of different software. The software does this for us and we have this application over here. And I think that as you chip through this, again, through automation and through AI, it's going to really streamline a lot of these, you know, internal enterprise processes, I think. But we're going to wake up a lot more, you know, efficient. So I want to ask you sort of a forward-looking question. So the last one of the session here, I do think it's a super exciting time to be in services. I think, I don't care what kind, if you're doing field services, you're doing professional services, support, I don't care what you're doing. It's a super exciting time because the technology is really changing how we operate. It's also changing the value propositions that we can deliver to our customers. I mean, we can really climb the value, you know, ladder here and deliver just more and more meaningful business impact for our customers. So as you look down the road, let's say 2030, because you're a young man, you're going to be still chipping at this in 2030. So when you're running a service organization in 2030, what's it going to look like to you? Is it smaller? Is it more digital? Is it structured differently? What do you think the future of services looks like?
I would say a big portion of our service team would be supporting the front-end service organization and the customer in a remote manner. I would say that is definitely one thing that will happen. It will definitely be more digital services that we will be delivering to our customers because of IIoT, because of AI capabilities being developed both at customer end and our end as well. I probably don't think that we can be more global than what we are today, unless we go to Mars or something maybe. The other thing that I see is that the engineers will be more account-based engineers, where they are at a customer site and helping them with their full factory operations, delivering them TCO advantages.
If I pause you just right there, so you're saying you feel like your field service engineers are going to be more tied to specific customers because they're going to be more intimate with those customers. Is that the assertion?
I think so, yeah. As we move our customers further up into the value game and then we really deliver the higher level contracts to our customers, I mean, the customers will also see the value of having our expert engineer at their customer site as well. And then really working with their teams, helping them develop their competencies as well, and then helping them where the issue is, not the technical issue, but actually in their entire process issue, in their entire production scheduling issue, for example, or those kind of things. I would say that's where we will see ourselves.
You know, as you describe that possibility, it's very much aligned with this concept of forward deployed engineers that you now see with AI companies, right? What are they doing there? They're taking a service type person or an extension of product engineering, but a very technical person, and they're putting them into the customer environment before the customer's bought anything to understand how they can add value, to really understand that particular customer's, you know, environment so they can co-create that value. And that's really kind of what you're describing. These people are going to be there looking for the next piece of value that they can unlock for the customer. That's exactly what you're describing. They're very intimate with the operations and they're always looking for that next way that your company can add value to their environment.
Totally agree. And it's a very interesting thing. And now that I think about 20 years ago, I was working for a supplier for General Motors and I was stationed at General Motors by the supplier to work with them for developing their new car, engine cooling and air conditioning systems. So now it all goes together, right?
Yeah, full circle.
Like a site-based engineer, yeah.
No, it's super interesting. Well, again, I think it's really exciting times for service organizations. I think there's a lot of nervousness out there for service people because the change is so fast. The technology is changing the nature of the job. And there's a lot of pressure for efficiencies, as I'm sure you know. I mean, there's constant, how are you going to deliver these services more efficient? How are you going to do that? So that's all there. But at the end of the day, I think when we come out on the other side of this, services is going to be more strategic, more impactful than ever for technology companies. I think there's no doubt about it. Well, Rajat, I really appreciate you coming and visiting us on Tectonic. It was a great discussion. And I always like to end these sessions with a question of the day. And my question for our audience is, how fast is your services organization evolving? Cheers, everybody. One of the main reasons we founded TSIA almost 20 years ago was to establish accurate operational benchmarks for technology service businesses that just didn't exist anywhere. Benchmarking is a killer tool to quickly understand your strengths and weaknesses. Benchmarking sets you on a journey that starts with where you are, points to what is possible, and identifies the business practices that will get you there. That's why I am super excited we decided to offer a free version of TSIA's industry-leading benchmarks with Performance Optimizer. Performance Optimizer is an easy-to-use benchmarking tool you can access from the TSIA website. You can assess operational strengths and weaknesses in multiple areas like customer success, professional services, support services, etc. And the Optimizer results prescribe specific actions to address specific challenges and opportunities. This is an amazing offer, and I am so proud we are doing this for all of our loyal Tectonic listeners who may not be corporate TSIA members. To check it out, visit tsia.com/free.